Chapter 6. Chains of Command. A war waged by committee is a war already lost. Sebastian Thor, Sermons. Volume 15, Chapter 504. Gaunt felt the monumental bulk of the curtain wall around him actually vibrate. The shellfire falling against its outer skin was a dull roar. Captain Dower and three other officers of the liaison staff led the oversight party up the stair drum of a secondary tower in the wall just west of the massive Hieronymo Sondar gate. Gaunt had brought Rawn and McColl, with Trooper Milo as his adjutant. General Grismond, with three of his senior Narmenians, and General Nash, with two of his regimental aides, made up the rest of the party, along with Tarion of the VPHC. They had a bodyguard detail of 30 Vervan primary troopers in full battle dress. The oversight party emerged onto the tower top, where hot breezes, stifling with physoline fumes, billowed over them. Three missile launchers were raised and ready here, their crews standing by, but additional awnings of flakboard had been erected in preparation for the visit of the dignitaries, and the launchers, with no safe room for their exhaust wash under this extra shelter, had fallen silent. The crews saluted the visitors smartly. "These are for our benefit?" Gaunt asked Tarion, indicating the freshly raised awnings. "Of course. You muzzle an entire defense tower so we can get a safe peek over the wall." Tarion frowned. "General Sturm has made it a standing requirement every time he visits the wall. I presumed you and the other eminent generals here would expect the same." "We've come to fight, not hide. Take them down and get these crews operational." Tarion looked round at Nash and Grismond. The Narmenian nodded briefly. "Gaunt speaks for us all," said Nash dryly. "We don't need any soft soap." Tarion turned from the group and began issuing orders to the launcher crews. The rest of the oversight party approached the rampart and took up magnoculars or used the available viewscopes on their tripod stands. Milo handed Gaunt his own scope from its pouch, and the commissar dialed the magnification as he raised it and gazed out. Below them, the miserable wasteland of the southern outer Habs lay exposed and broken. There was no discernible sign of life, but a hateful storm of enemy shelling and missiles pounded in across it at the hive. A fair amount fell short into the Habs, but a good percentage struck the curtain wall itself. Gaunt craned over for a moment, training his scope down the gentle slope of the wall. Its adamantine surface was peppered and scarred like the face of a moon, as far as he could see. Every few seconds, batteries to either side of them on the wall fired out, or the great siege guns in the emplacements below in the thickness of the wall recoiled and volleyed again. The vibration of the wall continued. "No way of knowing numbers or scale," began Nash. Grismond shook his head. "Not so, sir," he replied, pointing out to the very edge of the vast outer Hab waste. "As we have been told, this is no longer the work of their long-range artillery out in the grasslands. This is ground assault from closer range, armor moving in through the outer habitations and factories."
"Are you certain?" asked Gaunt.
"You can see the flashes of tank cannons as they fire. 4-5 kilometers out, in the very skirts of the outer Habs. Their weapons are on full elevation for maximum range, so the muzzle flashes are high and exposed. It is a simple matter of observing, counting, estimating."
Gaunt watched for flashes through his scope. Like Nash, he was an infantry commander, and he always appreciated technical insight from experienced officers with expertise in other schools of warfare. Grismond had a fine reputation as an armor commander. Gaunt fully trusted the Narmenian's judgment in this. As he looked, he began to discern the flickering display of brief light points out in the hinterland.
"Your estimate?"
asked Nash, also studying the scene and, like Gaunt, willing to listen to an expert opinion. Grismond glanced to his attending officers, who all looked up from their scopes.
"Nashin?"
The brigadier answered directly, his voice rich with the taut vowel sounds of the Narmenian accent.
"At first estimate, armor to the magnitude of 20,000 pieces. Straight form advance, with perhaps a forced salient to the east, near those tall cooling towers still standing. Innumerable rockets and mortars, harder to trace, but all mobile. 40, maybe 45,000.
The other Narmenians concurred. Grisman turned back to Gaunt and Nash as Tarion rejoined the group.
Nashin knows his stuff as well as me. You heard his numbers. A multiple regiment strength assault. Grand-scale armor attack. Yet, if what Commissar Cowell says is correct, not even a fraction of their numbers.
We can presume other army strengths are moving round through the mining district, the mud flats, perhaps the eastern outer Habs and the Hass East River Junction, too,
said Nash, dourly.
I can make no estimates of troop strength, however, Grisman added.
With permission, sir, Rawn said, and Gaunt nodded for him to continue. Rawn indicated the scene below with precise gestures of his nimble hands, his killer's hands.
If you watch the armor flashes, as General Grisman has suggested, they form a rough line, like a contour. Compare that to the fall of shells. The edge of the shortest falling shells, you can see that from the explosions and from the smoke fires, approximately matches that line, with a break of perhaps a kilometer and a half between armor and line of fire. That is the space we might expect the infantry advancing before the armor to occupy.
Nash nodded, impressed by the junior tennis insight.
We can't judge their tactics by our own,
Rawn went on.
I've seen the forces of the Chaos Scum perform many tactical aberrations on the fields of war, but assuming they are not intent on slaughtering their own troops, and assuming the widest margin of error, that shows us a clear belt of infantry advance. Even single line abreast, I'd say we were welcoming over 500,000 down there. Double that line, double the figure, triple it.
We may be senior cadre, but we follow your maths, Major, said Gaunt, and the others laughed darkly. A fine assessment, thank you.
At least 1,000,000, said McCall, suddenly. They all looked round at him.
Scout Sergeant?
Listen, sir, said McCall, and they all did, hearing nothing more than the persistent wail and wail echoes of the shelling and the crumps of explosions. Behind the impacts, a higher note, like a creaking, like the wind.
Gaunt fought hard to screen out the sounds of the assault bombing. He heard vague whispers of the sound McCall described.
Lasguns, sir. So many lasguns firing over each other that their individual sounds have become one shrieking note. You'd need a fifth of a lot of lasguns to make that sound.
At the back of the group, Dar noticed that Gaunt's adjutant, Milo, had crossed to the western lip of the tower and was gazing out. The adjutant was no more than a youth, his pale skin marked by a strange blue tattoo, as seemed to be the custom with so many of the ghosts. Dar crossed to him, limping.
"What do you see?"
he asked.
"What's that?"
asked Milo, pointing down to the east. Far away, round the curve of the massive curtain wall, past the Sondar and Vevere gates and the ruin of the ore works, a great black slope extended down out of the hive, 2 kilometers wide and 5 deep. It looked like a tide of tar. The curtain wall broke in a gap 1,400 meters wide to let it out.
"The spoil," Dara replied. "It's a mountain of rock refuse and processed ore waste from the smelteries and mine workings, one of the landmarks of Vervenhive," he laughed. "The wall is broken there. The spoil's been there longer than the wall. The wall was built around it. But still, it's a break in the defense. Don't worry, it's well protected. The 5th Division of my regiment, the spoilers, are dedicated to guarding that area. 20,000 men. They take their work seriously. Besides, the spoil itself is bloody treacherous, steep, unsafe, constantly slipping. It's probably harder to get past than the curtain wall itself. An enemy would waste thousands trying the foolish gambit like that."
Dower smiled encouragingly at Milo, and then turned away and rejoined the oversight tour. Milo felt sorry for him. Dower had no experience of the enemy, no knowledge of the way they expended and used their troops wholesale to gain their objectives. The soldiers of Vervenhive and the tactics they had evolved were too deeply focused upon the experience of fighting sane enemies. In the main group, Gaunt looked to his fellow regiment commanders. "Assessments. Why too much armor for an infantry-based counter-jab just now? But I'd as soon not let those bastards reach the walls," said Nash.
"I'd like to deploy my tank divisions to engage them out there," Grisman said, supported by whatever the North call armor units can supply. "We're not overwhelmed yet. If we can stop them in the outer habs clear of the main hive, we can push an advanced spearhead right down into the heart of them. For all their infamous numbers, they are extended over a massive area. That's how I'd go. Armored counter-assault, direct and sudden. Take the ground out from under them, if only a section. Then open a way to turn and flank them, cutting into their reserve lines. And dig a path for the infantry, too.
Nash agreed vehemently. I'll happily support an organized push of that sort.
So will I, Gaunt said. They've taken more than enough ground. We should stop them dead, even if only in this west sector.
Grisman nodded.
The gates this side of the hive must be opened. I'd gladly fight these bastards, no matter how many there are, but I need room for my machines to mobilize and maneuver. I'd rather do that out there in the habs than wait until they're at the wall.
Or inside it, Rawn added.
Something of a first, Gaunt smiled at his colleagues. Three regimental officers agreed on a tactical approach.
There was more general laughter, cut short by the first shrieks of the missile launchers on the tower, reopening fire now the awnings were down.
That assessment does not jibe with General Sturm's strategy, Tarion said from the side.
Gaunt looked round at him. I feel uneasy whenever a political officer uses a vague word like jibe.
Commissar Tarion, what do you mean?
I understand General Sturm's tactical recommendations for the prosecution of this conflict are already drawn up and under examination by Marshal Crow, the House Command Strategy Committee, and representatives of the noble houses. I hear they have the full support of Vice Marshal Anko and Commissar Cowell.
It sounds like they're as good as decided, Nash snarled, his heavy chin with its bristle of grey stubble set hard.
Are we wasting our time up here? What good is this oversight tour if they've already set a course?
Grismond asked.
I have had past dealings with the General of the Volpone, Gaunt remarked sourly. I have no doubt he feels himself to be the senior guard officer in this theatre, and the Hive Elders have lauded him as such. But he is not a man for personal confrontation. Better he gives us something to occupy our attentions while he makes his own decisions. Hence this sightseeing.
Gaunt turned sharply to look at Tarion.
And you'd know what those decisions were, wouldn't you, Tarion?
It's not my place to say, Colonel Commissar,
Tarion said flatly.
To hold the wall, to keep the gates sealed, to give up all territory outside, and to dig in for a sustained siege, trusting the shield, the curtain wall, and the army strength within Vervenhive to hold the enemy off forever, or at least until the winter breaks them.
They all looked round. As he finished speaking, Captain Dower shrugged, ignoring the murderous look the VPHC commander was giving him.
The plans were circulated this morning, with a magenta clearance rating. I have no reason to assume that clearance excluded senior echelon guard officers.
Thank you, Dower, Gaunt said. He looked back at Tarion. The generals and I wish to see Sturm and the Marshal. Immediately.
Quietly, the quintet of ochre-clad troops picked their way down the corridor of the bombed-out workshop, moving through the dust-filled air. Outside, a tank grated past down the river of debris that had once been Outhab Transit Street 287 FD. The soldiers wore ochre battle dress, shiny black leather webbing straps, and polished, newly stamped lasguns. On their heads were full-face composite helmets with flared, sneering features like blurred skulls and the crest of Ferrozoika inlaid on the brow. The squad checked each doorway and damaged section they came to. Golcolia could hear the hollow crackle of their terse vox signals barking back and forth. He slid back into cover and made a hand gesture that his company could read. They moved back, swallowed by the shadows and the dust. Gol let the five troopers advance down the corridor far enough until the last one was standing on the false flooring. Then he connected the bare end of the loose wire in his hand to the terminals of the battery pack. The concussion mine tore out a length of the corridor and obliterated the last trooper where he stood, tearing the one directly in front of him into pieces with fragments of shrapnel and shards of bone from his exploded comrade. The other three fell, then scrambled up, firing blind in the smoke. Bright, darting bars of lasfire pierced the smoke cover like reef fish scudding through cloudy water. Gull smashed out his fake wall and came down on the first of them from the rear, swinging the hook bill of his axe rake down through helmet and skull. Sergeant Haller dropped down from the ceiling joists where he had been crouching and felled another of them, killing him with point-blank shots from his auto-pistol as his body weight flattened the trooper. The remaining Zoican bastard switched to full auto and swung wild. His withering close-range shots punched right through a flakboard wall partition and blew the guts and thighs out of machine-smith Vidor, who had been waiting to spring out from behind it. Nessa came out of cover under some loose sacking and slammed the rock knife into the back of the Zoican's neck. She held on, screaming and yanking at the blood-slicked knife grip as the trooper bucked convulsively. By the time he dropped, his head was nearly sawn off. Gol hurried forward, picking Nessa up and pulling her off the corpse. She handed the bloody rock knife to him, shaking.
"Keep it," he mouthed.
She nodded. Eardrums ruptured by a close shell on the seventh day, she would never hear again without expensive up-hive surgery and implants, which meant simply she would never hear again. She was a trainee medic from the Outer Habs, not the lowest of the low, but way, way down in the hive class system.
"You did good,"
Gol signed. She smiled, but the fear in her eyes and the blood on her face diffused the power of the expression and diluted the beauty of the young woman.
"Not so easy," she signed back.
She'd learned to sign her remarks early on. Captain Fencer, the Emperor save his soul, had trained her well and explained how she could not modulate the volume of her own voice. Now she was deaf. Gol looked round. Halla and the other members of Gol's team had recovered 4 working lasguns, 2 las pistols, and a bunch of ammunition webs from the dead by then.
"Go, move,"
Gol ordered, emphasizing his words with expressive sign gestures for the deaf. Of his company of 9, 6 were without hearing. He took a last look at Vidor's corpse and nodded a moment of respect. He had liked Vidor. He wished the brave machinesmith had found the chance to fight. Then he followed his company out. They moved out of the workshop, circuiting back around through a side alley and into a burned-out ecclesiarchy chapel. The bodies of the Ministorum brothers lay all around, venting swarms of flies. They had not abandoned their holy place, even when the shells began to fall. Halla crossed to the altar, straightened the slightly skewed imperial eagle, and knelt in observance. Tears dripped down his face, but he still remembered to sign his anguish and his prayer to the Emperor rather than speak it. Gol noticed this and was touched and impressed by the soldiers' dual devotion to the Emperor and to their continued safety. Gol got his company into the chapel, spreading them out to cover the openings and find the obvious escape routes. The ground shook as tank rounds took out the workshop where they had sprung their trap. In the cover of the explosions, he dared to speak, signing at the same time.
"Let's find the next ones to kill," he said.
"A squad of 6, moving in from the west,"
hissed Loomgirl Banda, setting down her lasgun and peering out of a half-broken lancet window.
"Drill form as before,"
Gol Collier signed to his company.
"Form on me. Let's set the next snare."
Lord Heimlich Chass sent his servitors and bodyguard away. The chief of the guard, Rudrek, his weapon dutifully shrouded, tried to refuse, but Chass was not in the mood for argument. Alone in the cool, gloomy family chapel of House Chass, high up in the main spire upper sectors, the Lord prayed diligently to the soul of the undying Emperor. The ghosts of his ancestors welled up around him, immortalized in statuary. Heimlich Chass believed in ghosts. They spoke to him. He unlocked the casket by the high altar between the family stasis crypts with a Geno key that had been in his family for generations. He raised the velvet padded lid, hearing the moan of ancient suspenser fields, and lifted out Hieronymo's amulet.
"What are you doing, Father?"
Merity Chass asked. His daughter's voice startled him and almost made him drop the precious thing.
"Merity, you shouldn't be here," he murmured.
"What are you doing?"
she asked again, striding forward under the flaming sconces of the chapel, her green velvet dress whispering as she moved.
"Is that—"
her voice trailed away. She could not utter the words.
"Yes, given to our house by great Hieronymo himself."
"You're not thinking of using it. Father!"
He stared down into her pained, beautiful face.
"Go away, my daughter. This is not for your eyes."
"No!"
she barked. She so reminded him of her mother when she turned angry that way.
"I am grown. I am the heir, female though I may be. Tell me what you are doing."
Chass sighed and let the weight of the amulet play in his hands.
"What I must. What is good for the hive? There was a reason old Hieronymo bequeathed this to my father. Salvador Sondar is a maniac. He will kill us all.
You have raised me to be respectful of the high house, father, she said,
a slight smile escaping her frown. That was her mother again, Heimlich noticed.
It amounts to treason,
his daughter whispered. He nodded, and his head sank.
I know what it amounts to. But we are on the very brink now. Hieronymo always foretold this moment.
He hugged her. She felt the weight of the amulet in his hands against her back.
You must do what you must, father,
Merity said. Like a slow pollen-gathering insect, a vox drone hummed lazily in the chapel and crossed to the embracing figures. It bleeped insistently. Chas pulled away from his daughter, savoring the sweet smell of her hair.
A vote is being taken in the upper legislature. I must go.
Bumbling like a moth, the drone hovered in front of the noble lord, leading him out of the chamber.
Father?
Heimlich looked back at his beloved child, hunched and frightened by the cold marble familial crypt.
I will support you in whatever you do, but you must tell me what you decide. Don't keep me in the dark.
I promise, he said.
The Privy Council was a circular theatre set on the spine floor above the spectacular main hall of the legislature, and it was reserved for the noble houses only. The domed roof was a painted frieze of the Emperor and the god-machines of Mars hovering in radiant clouds. Columns of warm yellow light stabbed down from the edges of the circular ceiling and lit the velvet thrones of the high houses. Apart from Chas, they were all there. Gavunda, Yetch, Rodin, Anko, Crow, Pedestro, Nomferenti, and Vwick. Marshal Crow stood by his brother, the old, wizened Lord Crow, in deep conference. Vice Marshal Anko, beaming and obsequious, was introducing General Sturm to his resplendently gowned cousin, Lord Anko. Commissar Cowell was diplomatically greeting Lords Gavunda and Nomferenti. Servants and house retainers thronged the place, running messages, fetching silver platters of refreshments, or simply guarding their noble masters with shrouded sidearms. A gong sounded four strokes. The main gilt shutter at the east side of the room slid up into the ceiling with a hiss, and Master Legislator Anafi limped into the chamber, his opalescent robes glinting in the yellow light, his beribboned tricorn nodding with each heavy shuffle he took across the embroidered carpet. He was using the long golden scepter of his office as a stick. Child pages held his train and carried his gem-encrusted vox-picked drone and book of hive lore before him on tasseled cushions. Anofi reached his place. He adjusted the silver arm of the vox-phone and spoke.
Noble houses, your careful attention.
All looked round and quickly took their places. Cowell, Sturm, and the other military men withdrew to one side. Noble Chas's seat was vacant. Anofi thumbed through the data on a slate held up by one of his pages, and he set a palsy-trembling finger to his moist lips.
A matter to vote, in all precision, before these houses, the ratification of the defense plans our noble friend, General Notches Sturm, has drawn up. The matter need not be lengthened further by discourse. The hive, Emperor granted wealth and longevity, awaits.
Six ascent runes, fizzling holograms, lit the air above Anofi. Rodin and Pedestro houses voted against with dark-tinged, threatening lights.
Garrett,
said Anofi, simply. The Privy Council began chattering and moving again. A shutter of herringbone steel to the west side of the chamber slid open, and Noble Chas, accompanied by his bodyguard, entered the chamber. An awkward hush fell. It remained in place as Chas descended the steps, crossed the chamber, and took his appointed seat. Once they had folded his great silk train over the throne back, his bodyguard and servants stood away. Chas gazed around the circular hall. Several of his fellow nobles did not meet his gaze.
You have voted. I was not present.
You were summoned,
Lord Anko said.
If you miss the given time, your vote is forfeit.
You know the rules, noble lord,
wheezed Anofi.
I know when I have been excluded. Come now,
Anofi said,
There is no exclusion in the upper parliament of Vervenhive. Given the extraordinary circumstances of this situation, I will allow you to vote now.
Chas looked around again, very conscious of the way Lord Crow would not look at him.
I see the matter has been voted 6-2. My vote, whichever way I meant to cast it, would be useless now.
Cast it anyway, brother lord,
gurgled Gavunda through the silver-inlaid wire-box augmenter that covered his mouth like an ornate, crouching spider. Chas shook his head.
I spoil my vote. There is no point to it.
A group of figures was entering through the east hatch. Commissar Tarion was trying to delay them, but they pushed past. It was Gaunt, Grismond, Nash, and their senior officers.
I can scarce believe your guile, Sturm, Nash spat, facing the other general.
Gilbert moved forward to confront the Rowan commander, but Sturm held him back with a curt snap of his fingers. Gaunt crossed directly to the master legislator's place and took the data slate from the hands of the surprised page. He reviewed it.
So, it's true,
he said, looking up at Sturm and Marshal Crow.
General Sturm's strategic suggestions have been agreed then ratified by the upper council,
Vice Marshal Anko said smoothly,
and I strongly suggest you and the other off-world commanders with you show some order of respect and courtesy to the workings and customs of this high parliament. We will not have our ancient traditions flouted by...
You're all fools,
Gaunt said carelessly, setting the slate down and turning away. If you care more for ceremonial traditions than life, you've made a serious error here. You've killed this hive, and all of us with it, Nash snapped, bristling with fury.
Gaunt took the big Rowan general by the shoulder and moved him away from confrontation.
I am surprised at you, Marshal,
Grismond said, his stiff anger just held in check, like an attack dog on a choke chain, as he looked at Crow.
From our meetings, I'd believe your grasp of tactics was better than this.
Marshal Crow got up.
I'm sorry at your unhappiness, General Grismond. But General Sturm's plan seems sound to me. I have the hive to think of. And Commissar Cowell, who has, let's be fair, actually encountered our foe, concurs.
Grismond shook his head sadly.
What would you have done?
Lord Chas asked. There was a lot of shouting and protesting, all of it directed at Chas.
Lord Chas has a right to know.
Ibram Gaunt's clear, hard voice cut the shouting away. Gaunt turned to face the nobleman.
After due observation, Generals Nash, Grismond, and I would have opened the southwest gates and launched armor to meet them, infantry behind. A flanking gesture to front them outside of the wall, rather than give up all we have.
Would that have worked?
Chas asked.
We'll never know, Gaunt replied. But we do know this. If we wait until they reach the wall... Where do we have to fall back to after that?
Nowhere.
Noble Chas wanted to question further, but the Privy Council dissolved in uproar, and Gaunt marched out, closely followed by the furious Grismond and Nash.
Commissar! Commissar Colonel!
In the crowded promenade hall outside the Privy Council, where parliamentary and house aides thronged back and forth with guilders and house ordinary delegates, Gaunt paused and turned. A tall, grim-looking man in ornate body armor was pushing through the crowds after him, a satin cloth covering the weapon in his right hand. Gaunt sent his staff ahead with the other generals and turned to face the man. A household bodyguard, he was sure. The man approached and made a dutiful salute.
I am Rutrek, lifeguard of His Excellency Lord Chas of Noble House Chas. My lord requests a meeting with you at your earliest convenience.
The man handed Gaunt a small token seal, with the Imperial Eagle on one side and the Chas coat of arms on the other.
With this, you may be admitted to House Chas at all times. My lord will await.
Gaunt looked at the crest as the lifeguard bowed and departed, swallowed by the crowd. Now what? He wondered. Salvador Sondar half woke, a dream teetering on the edge of memory. The water around him was sweet and warm, and pink bioluminescence glowed softly. The chatter murmured at him, soft, soothing, compelling. He was there almost all the time now, asleep or awake. Sondar listened in the water.
What? What is it? What do you want?
The southern outer Habs were ablaze, and ash smog was being driven through the rubble-strewn streets by the crosswinds surging cyclonically from the hottest blazes. Despite fierce pockets of guerrilla resistance, the Zoican forces pushed up through the ruins in spaced phalanxes of infantry and columns of armor, thousands of them, grinding ever north through the confusion. The first of them were now just a kilometer from the curtain wall.